You're listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners. To donate, click on the Canada Helps button or go to westhill.net/donate.
I'm heading out into the same terrain that I have headed out into over the last few weeks, aside from those special services when Kathleen Wynn spoke and last week when we were doing communion together. But I wanted to reflect on last week particularly and my experience of it as it unfolded. We've been moving away from a traditional understanding of communion over the last couple of years and have gone down on our visitors and travelers Sundays to the hall, the lower hall, and just sort of said a prayer over the meal as it happened there. But this year we decided to bring it back up into this space to share it. John Dominic Crossan, a scholar who looks at the history of early Christianity and explored the understanding of what that early Eucharistic meal was, would have been impressed with what he saw last week. Because that early meal in the early Christian communities was a meal of equity, a meal that brought everyone to the table, a meal that was often paid for or covered by a wealthy patron, but the table was laden by gifts that came from anyone who was able to bring something. And anyone who was able to do anything to add to that meal was welcome to partake of it. Of course, anyone who wasn't able to offer something was welcome at that table to partake as well. And so it was about creating a space that people could come together and share in community and lose whatever difference kept them apart in an economic way or a religious way beyond that table. Last week when I asked the servers to bring the food forward and it just kept coming, the tables were laden. Half of what Scott and I had prepared went home with us. It was just remarkable to see that come together and to watch people gather around, to honor and celebrate that ancient tradition, even though some of you might not have even known that's what you were doing, but to create a community and to honor it in this space. And that indeed was what those first meals were about. And so I found it a very moving experience and wanted to thank you for creating such a sacred place in which that could take place. When I use the word sacred, I'm talking about not something that's divine and otherworldly and supernatural. I'm talking about something that we can't risk losing, that's so important to us that we take special care of it and we make sure that it's something that others have access to as well so that they can have it in their lives. And so this was a very sacred place and a very sacred activity last week, and I thank you all for that. I want to tell you a little anecdote that will help you understand how fleeting wisdom can be in my life sometimes. Some of you may remember there was an ad on television a few years ago, and I have no idea whose ad it was, but it had two escalators. There was a man going down one and a woman up the other, and about just as they were about getting close to each other, the escalators stopped. And they were left standing on the escalator, and they looked around and around and around, and then they both started yelling for help. As though they couldn't just walk up or down the escalator. This week I lost my BlackBerry, and I use my BlackBerry to get into my Gmail. It sends a code to my BlackBerry so that someone trying to get into my Gmail can't do it unless they have the code. Well, if they've got my BlackBerry, they can get into it now. But so I couldn't actually print out the notes for my sermon on Donna's computer today. I sent them to myself by email and then didn't have my BlackBerry to get the code, so I couldn't print them out. There were 8 things on that list to remind me what I was going to speak about. 8. Never occurred to me that I could pick up a pen and write those 8 things down. And so I could ramble all over the place today because I didn't have my BlackBerry. little bits of practical wisdom there. But this road that we have been walking down, this understanding of wisdom over these last few weeks that we've been speaking about it, is familiar terrain to most of us. As I was preparing for today, I realized actually that's what I preach about pretty much every Sunday, is some aspect, some component of wisdom, and our need to grow it, to become comfortable with how it works and how we respond to everyday things so that we can bring wisdom into the world in a significant way. When Scott mentioned the American elections and everybody laughed, it may be because we aren't seeing a whole lot of wisdom unfolding in those debates and in those conversations that are taking place around that looming election. But it's wisdom that we need in our communities. It's wisdom that we were looking for around that table at John McKay's office earlier this week. It's wisdom that we're calling our elected officials to in terms of how to get a few textbooks to schools on Aboriginal land and in those Aboriginal communities where they are needed. We need wisdom in our lives. But the 8 things that I was going to speak to you about were what I referred to earlier that Stephen Hall calls the neural pillars of wisdom. And he calls them that because he's finding the basis for these different elements of wisdom in our neurological makeup. And in his exploring that and uncovering the work and making accessible to the general public the work of highly specialized researchers, he's helping us understand that we don't just grow up learning how to be nice and developing compassion and learning how to reason with morals as a bit of a guideline. A lot of that is hardwired in our brains. A lot of it is already there. We have evolved the capacity for much of that in our brains. And so I want to run through just a bit of those topically, because it's a very dense subject area when you get into the neurological findings and the use of new magnetic resonance imaging techniques, which are telling us so much more about the brain and have been for just a very few years. But some of the different neural pillars that Hall has found, the first one that he speaks about is emotional resonance and emotional resilience. We bring our emotions to decisions. We make decisions often emotionally because we're at a particular place in our lives. Things happen and we've got a reaction to them. And so we shoot off a decision and find ourselves with concrete boots on and unable to move from a decision that we may have unwisely made in a moment of heated emotion. We do that more often, the story tells us, when we're young. And some of the researchers have been following a number of people over the course of many years in what's called the beeper experiment, because these people are willing to wear a beeper that will go off at any particular given time, and they have to write down what emotional space they're in at that time. You can imagine, I mean, just run through what happens during your days and your nights, and imagine how you might respond if that beeper suddenly went off in the middle of that, whatever it happened to be. Sometimes it'd be just an ordinary thing happening, and you could say, oh, I'm feeling this or I'm feeling that. Sometimes you'd be interrupted in things that you didn't want to be interrupted in, and so your emotional response, what you'd write down, may have more to do with the interruption than what you were actually doing. But following these people for many years with this beeper experiment has shown some very interesting things around their emotional attachment to decision-making and to bringing wisdom to those choices. And one of the things you'll be very happy to know, because you're a lovely, mature audience, one of the things that you will be happy to know is that as we age, we make wiser decisions. Now, we think that it's because we've collected experience, and so we know better than to do the things we did when we were young, and some of them I really do know better than to do those things again. But really, the researchers are finding that it has less to do with what we know and more to do with our perspective on time. That it's really that when we're young, when people are young, they're more likely, given a situation that has a positive or a negative outcome, they're more likely to dwell on the possible negatives when they're making their decision. Whereas you folks who are beyond high school will put less energy into thinking what bad stuff might happen. You'll focus more on the good stuff that might happen. And if there's bad stuff that happens, well, you know you'll cope with it then. And so your decisions are based more on a positive perspective, on a positive attitude. That timeline also places you along your life, that string of billion, 7 million moments, that just an indication of my age, I'm roughly that old, 1,700,000,000 moments old, and I don't have a billion moments left. And when we realize we don't have as many moments left as we have accrued in our lifetime, it gives us a different perspective. We look at things differently, and we're able to cancel out a lot of those things that would have absorbed us when we were younger. And so we take the time to make the decision that is right for us and find ourselves fewer and fewer times locked in those concrete boots that have held us to a decision we regret. I remember watching a young woman one time who had a number of phobias that would get out of hand at a moment's notice and pitch her into situations where she couldn't make decisions that would actually control her emotion. And she shared with me that she was getting ready to go to the dentist one day and felt that fear start building within her. She'd never actually been afraid of going to the dentist before. It was something new, something completely different happening in her life. Potentially the beginning of another whole new phobia that might take over her life. And as soon as she felt it happening, she went, wait a minute, I don't have to do this. And set that feeling back, put it down, stifled it entirely, and was able to go to the dentist and not end up with another phobia ruling her life and controlling her life. It's almost as though she had hit this place in her maturity where she didn't have to be ruled by her emotions, but she could make a choice to rule them instead. As we make decisions to rule our emotional response, we're able to make decisions on a variety of things that are much wiser than they may have been. Now, Hall takes us through a variety of other steps. These are the eight things I was going to write down. Moral reasoning, being able to bring a sense of our morals, our understanding to situations and determining whether we are acting in compliance with what we have decided are those things we are going to act by. Compassion, altruism, all of these are things that Hall takes us on this journey with researchers, I don't know what you call them, scientists who are looking at these different ways that the brain is controlled. There's another little part of our brain, and I've mentioned it here before, and I think it's my favorite part, because as I was researching for my book on prayer, I read a lot about it, and it's coming up again and again and again in the research that these psychologists are doing that Hall brings forward in his book, and that's the anterior cingulate. We all know that amygdala part, or we may not know, but it's two little almonds that sit underneath the big fat part of your brain. And it's the part where we have that response, sometimes called the reptilian brain, where we get all of the responses that are innate, the fight, flight, freeze responses to conflict, to any kind of exposure to fear. The amygdala sends our response in whichever way is the most appropriate appropriate one at the time based on what we're seeing in our peripheral vision, who's standing in front of us, what they've got with them, what we remember of our history with them in the past. We can respond the way any reptile will respond if we just do exactly what it is our amygdala tells us to do. But the anterior cingulate, which has kind of been that little fold up above it, is much newer and a much more interesting part of our brain because it gives us options, and the options are beyond just fight, flight, freeze. The options are that we can make decisions because that little part of our brain will fire our thinking forward into the prefrontal cortex where we can make much more complex decisions. And here's where I think wisdom resides, is a lot in that anterior cingulate, that part of our brain. Because when it's healthy and it flips our thinking to this front part of our brain, we get to consider options. We get to think, okay, what's the effect of my action going to be on John if I do this? Or where am I going to be in 5 years if I make that decision and what's my life going to be like? Or how is my choosing to purchase this product affecting someone who lives around the world? We have this little conference table up there. You know I'm speaking like we don't really have a conference table. You know that, right? Okay. We have this conference table up there, and we get to sit at that conference table with all our better selves and with perhaps even some people around us that we can bring into our brains, and because I know exactly what Scott would think about that. And I can actually draw on the wisdom of people who have died before because I know what they might have thought about that. So I bring all of those to the conference table, and we have a conversation about what the best choice of action is. What should we do? What's our course? Where do we go from here? If that anterior cingulate, that little thing folded in above the amygdala, is not very healthy, then it's more often than not going to let stuff just go with what the amygdala says. Okay? So we just like get out of there, we make the decision fast, we react, and we end up with those concrete boots on. Because we made a decision without thinking about where I was going to be 5 years from now, without remembering how Scott felt about that, without putting any kind of context into the decision I'm making. I just react in this reptilian way, and so my decisions lack wisdom in a big way. I don't have the potential to respond wisely in any situation if that anterior cingulate is not healthy and strong. Now the reality is our anterior cingulates are all different. Because we were all of us only born with about 15% of the spindle cells that are in our anterior cingulate that are responsible for doing that work of shoving you to that conference table or having you react like some kind of a snake. That's not a reptile, is it? Is a snake a reptile? Okay, good. We'll stick with snake. Wise choice. That 15% that you have when you're born is a good start. It's a very good start, but it's not enough. Based on what your first 8 to 10 months of your life were like, you will have either a full slate of those spindle cells or they will not have developed. Think about that. If you are in an environment that is rich empathically, that in which you have consistent eye-to-eye contact with a caregiver who is caring for you well, holding you, touching you, responding to your needs appropriately and in a short period of time, you won't develop, if you don't have that, you won't develop the spindle cells that you need in your anterior cingulate to be able to get to that conference table when you need to get there. Now, we all like to think, okay, I got them, no problem. My mom did all that. I know some of you know your moms didn't do that. And I want to remind you that until about the 1970s, in many places, it was still taught, physicians still taught us, and psychologists still taught us not to coddle our children. Don't kiss them, you know. Some even said, you know, a handshake in the morning and a pat on the head at night, and that's all you should do for your children. And I think about my father's ability to be empathic, and I think, oh my goodness. 15% maybe isn't enough for us to be able to get to that conference table where we're going to come up with wise and compassionate and empathic and altruistic decisions that we need to make. And we can look around our world and we can watch how things are unfolding in our world in many places and in many ways. And we can see how that's affecting a neurological development, which makes a very big difference in how our world works. Now, the reality is that if you're shy on spindle cells, you can still work on making what you have healthy, and there are meditations that you can do for that, and I introduced some of them a while ago, but we'll put some of them on the website again. There are meditations that you can do for that that will strengthen your spindle cells, constantly working at it, being aware that there is a conference table up there that you can pull a chair up to, even if you don't have the neurological capacity to actually fire you there, if you can, like, bypass some of that circuitry and get there anyway, that will work for you. We have to find ways to get not just ourselves at that conference table, but a whole lot of other people in our own conference table. And we have to create an environment, a world, in which those conference tables are easily accessible by all. Not the one in my brain, but the one in each individual's brain. So that it's there, and they know it's there, and they use it, and we come to decisions that are empathic, that affect our world in profound ways, because they take into account not just ourselves or the people that look like us or the people that happen to lock themselves in the same house that night or the few, you know, relations or our nation or our hockey team or our baseball, whatever we may define as a privileged group in our own care. If we're going to get beyond caring for just that privileged group, that conference table has got to be pretty big, and we have to have the capacity to get to it. When I look at the world and I see, even in this neighborhood, the challenges that many live with and that communities and individuals and families have to cope with, the idea of drawing a conference table for everybody seems almost ridiculous sometimes. Because the challenges are concrete and they're now, and we need to deal with them immediately. We don't have time sometimes to make the choices that we would like to make. But each one of you lives somewhere in a community beside somebody, whether it's in a building or whether it's in a home or whether it's in a long-term care facility, wherever you hang out. There are people around you that may or may not have the capacity to get to that conference table with ease, that may or may not have a strong anterior cingulate that can help them make wise choices. And you might not have it yourself, based on the ways that you were raised and the things that you had to cope with in your life and the ways that you learned to survive. But in this community, I want to create a conference table that's outside all of our brains, that doesn't depend on just the few spindle cells that I have and the few days perhaps that they're fragile and the few days that they're strong and the difference between those. I want to create a conference table, not just in this community of faith, but in every community of faith, where the ideas and the wisdom of everybody in that community gets to that table. So that if I don't have the capacity or you don't have the capacity to make that decision yourself, there's a place where you can go and help that conversation take place. Where we can work as communities to create and build wisdom in our wider communities. And I think churches, I think places of faith, institutions of faith, are a really good place to have that happen. A lot's going to have to change. We know that. We've done some of that. But for us to influence and inspire communities of faith around us, we need to be about doing that work ourselves. Creating a safe space for difficult conversations to take place. For pulling up that conference table and getting as many voices around it as we possibly can. Offering each person the respect and the time that it takes for them to get to whatever they need to place on that table. So our decisions can be wise, and that means compassionate, altruistic, based on moral reasoning, based on emotional resonance and resilience. Our communities can come up with decisions that are good, not just for the community, but for each individual in it. So I'm back to that table we created last week. Table that didn't have chairs around it. We didn't have a conversation, a significant conversation at it. But we made it a table that was open for everyone. And we offered at that table strength to people who might be faltering. And we went to that table if we needed strength. We've begun the process of creating space in this community for those conversations to take place. And I am so grateful that we have done that. And I am so inspired that we have done that. And I know that one day the wider church will be grateful that we have done that. And they too may be inspired that we have created a way to bring people together, to share wisdom, and to call this world to attentiveness, to intentionality, to integrity, and to decisions that will be in the best interests of all. Amen.